Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fourth series of The Human Podcast, a place to hear extraordinary human stories that celebrate the limitless potential of human beings. So often, our personal stories of tragedy and survival are left untold, hidden behind the facade of our ordinary lives. Human has been created to make them more seen, more heard, and more celebrated. Because by doing so, I think we can all feel more connected to our shared humanity. So if the world is feeling like a dark or difficult place, join us and let your heart be ignited by the fire of the human spirit.
So the person that we have with us today is somebody that I have wanted to have on this podcast for such a long time. And so it is a very, very special thing for me that she is our season four finale guest, absolutely incredible Zoe Buckman. Zoe is a multidisciplinary artist working in sculpture, installation and photography, exploring the themes of feminism, morality and equality. Zoe was born and raised in Hackney in London, but has lived and worked and raised her beautiful daughter for many years now in Brooklyn in New York. After a series of triumphant shows, Zoe is now being compared to and exhibited alongside some of the greatest feminist artists of our time, Louise Bourgeois, Mary Kelly, Tracy Emin. So it feels very, very special to have this time with Zoe today to talk about her work, possibly how her own stories are held within them, and what it means to her to have arrived at this point in her career when it feels things are heading in a stratospheric direction for her. So Zoe, I'm in London, you're in New York, but I feel like we're just sat next to each other.
I know.
It's so lovely to have you. Before we get into anything else, my love, how are you today?
Oh, I'm so good. I'm really glad to be sitting down and chatting to you. And I'm honoured to be your finale.
So are we.
Yeah, truly. I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing right now. Well, so thank you.
Oh, good. Me too, darling. Me too. So Zoe, I've heard you say that everything you've made has always been speaking to the female experience, whether that is personal or political. And your latest show is about our capacity to go through violence, miscarriage, heartbreak and abandonment, but to choose joy. I just wondered if we could just start by you speaking to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting because I'm realizing that I don't really make choices of like, oh, it's time I started embracing joy in my work. Like, it's never been a cognizant choice. I've always created things in real time from either difficult experiences that I'm going through at the time or have just gone through, or things that I find complicated and like ideas and issues that I'm grappling with, and then I make the work. And sometimes it's something that I'm figuring out, but there was definitely like a dark time when the work was therefore darker and I was more in the trenches of loss of my mother, coming off the heels of a divorce, and I then found myself in a relationship in which my sexual, emotional, and physical self was under threat. And yeah, so the work was really exploring those things, and then I had, I guess I processed a lot of that, and I realized that I could engage more with this, I guess, joy and wonderment of our capacity to metabolize pain. It's not something, particularly with grief and the loss of my mom, it's not something that I'm not there yet, like, and we'll get to this later, like, I'm not in a place of gratitude, like, I'm really fucking angry that she died. But I think when it comes to other losses and traumas, and those include, you know, sexual assault, abortion, miscarriage, abandonment, these things, I am really appreciative of our, and when I say our, I mean like women and fem-bodied people, our capacity to heal and lean on each other. And so my work, this latest show, Blood Work, which was at Pippi Howlsworth Gallery in London, there was still a lot of pain in the work, but there was more joy finally. And people said to me, like, oh, how beautiful that, like, you're giving us hope right now when we all need it after the pandemic and all these things. And I was like, I guess my thinking is, like, it's awesome that people feel that way and that's really beautiful, but it wasn't a cognizant choice. Like, we all need a bit of joy. It was that I realized that I could still connect to my inner well, my inner source of creativity and joy, and like reclaim myself. And in doing that, particularly after heartbreak, I think you forge a stronger relationship to being alone, and you realize that you're surrounded by lots of women, particularly here in New York, because everyone's single, we're all alone, but none of us are alone. And so in that work, there are a lot of depictions of friends of mine, female, or, you know, female presenting survivors of so many different things, from illness, death of a family member, racism, rape, and yet we all have this capacity to, like, use our bodies to express our joy. And that's really what my last show was exploring. I just, like, dumped a lot on you right there.
No, I mean, there's so much there that I just want to pick up on. But one of the things that you said about the impossible task of sort of metabolizing loss and certain traumas, you know, I think when it comes, you know, on you know, you said you haven't fully metabolized the loss of your mum yet. Of course you haven't. I don't think we ever do. And it just made me think about, like, you know, metabolizing some of these biggest, most painful things we have to go through is literally like ingesting fucking razor blades into the system. That's how deeply they cut you open in the metabolizing process. And but then how interestingly, out of those deep, deep, deep wounds, isn't it extraordinary how kind of beautiful things can grow from something so terrible? Do you know what I mean? And how a terrible thing that happens is often actually not an ending, it's a new beginning. And how incredible it is that from a terrible thing, these shoots of beauty can grow within it. And that's really just what it made me feel hearing you describe the work, and how you are expressing joy, or the expression of joy from something that, you know, from certainly a whole range of experiences for you, which have been incredibly, incredibly challenging and difficult.
Yeah, you're so right. It's like we think about joy and melancholy or loss or grief as these sort of binaries, but of course, like experiencing one only further impacts your capacity to experience the other.
Yeah.
And your gratitude and your ability, any trauma, any loss takes a piece out of you, but it also it helps you see those missing pieces in other people and connect human to human on a deeper level, I believe. Like I wouldn't want to get to the end of my life having not experienced loss and you know, difficulty and adversity, and because like, well, then you're not really engaged in the human condition in a real way. And it's not like, because I want to be an artist and I want to be a tortured artist, like it's not fucking fun, none of this is fun. But I do feel more grown and more strong now than I ever have, and I know 100% it's because it's the overcoming. Do you know what I mean? It's the surviving and the overcoming that grows you up and strengthens you to a place where, like, now, frankly, like, men are terrified of me. I can't get a date with men. I can get dates with women easier than I can with men. But it's like, she's too strong now.
That's interesting, isn't it? What do you think that's about, though? Do you know what I mean?
I think it's because they're now finally faced with somebody who doesn't need anything from them. Like, I might want something, like I do want love, I do want partnership, but I don't actually need it, because I've had to figure out how to be whole without it. And I think because men are so, a lot of, I'm speaking in very sort of like sweeping terms, I know, in very gender terms, but we're just going to have to go with it for today. Because cisgendered men are, I think, sort of infected with toxic masculinity, and I feel sorry for them for it. They don't really know how to deal with somebody who doesn't need them and isn't a dependent. And so now I am finding that, yeah, cis men run for the hills, and it's like, I'm all right with it. I'm like, bye, bye, see you later. There's another one. But yeah, I
mean, later.
To, like, veer off into that. See you later, dude.
Sauce. Yeah, God, I mean, there is, I mean, there's so much that I want to say. I don't know if I can say this on the fucking record. Another thing that really struck me in what you were just saying in the answer to my question before was the stuff around how your work speaks to a kind of intergenerational experience as well. So your intergenerational, multi-generational experiences, and there's this, and again, I mean, that your kind of observation of those intergenerational experiences combined with what I think is, as you say, you know, your own lived experience creates this incredibly potent heart and soul and kind of language to what you do, Zoe, which is, I'm sure, why it's, you know, capturing the minds and hearts and imaginations of people all over the world now. And I was really struck by this in the case of just what I've, I mean, I haven't seen the whole film, but just online, of the Show Me Your Bruises Then film, which... is this amazing short film that was written and performed and directed by you, featuring Kush Jumbo and Sienna Miller. And it's all based on a poem of the same name, a kind of freeform poem that you wrote. And the film is described as building a portrait of the multi-generational experience of domestic violence and explores the shame and stigma prescribed to the female body in patriarchal society. I'd just love you to tell us a little bit more about that.
Thank you for mentioning the film, because it really is, I I think it's the work that I'm most proud of, really. And it feels like, yeah, it's interesting because it's almost like it kind of encapsulates so much of what I've been working on previously. It almost like goes backwards in time as well as forward for me and my artistic practice. But yeah, basically the reason, like the way that that started, it was 2018 and my mum was still alive though she was sick. And it was right after like the Me Too moment burst open. And I was asked by the New York Times to write a short essay about my experience in 2018. And I knew that what they wanted me to do was write about, you know, violence. And I decided, they told me that the essay could be as abstract as I wanted it to be. So I decided to weave together little snippets of conversations and things that men had said to me and things that I had said to men. And at the time I was in this relationship where I wasn't safe, but because my mum was dying, I wasn't ready to face that. And I kind of clung to it and wanted to keep up appearances, which is a whole other thing. Yeah. And so I started to weave together this little poem and I sent it off to the New York Times and they said it was way too abstract. So I parked that there and I wrote them something much more basic. And I sent it to my mom and she loved it. And she was like, you're really onto something here. Go, go, go. She was my biggest cheerleader. I have so much regret about and guilt over the fact that it wasn't until after she died that I expanded the text and I started to bring in some of her experiences and her writing. I don't know why I didn't do that before. And I wish so much that she could see how she's in my work so much. But I didn't really put her in my work before when she was alive, and nothing would have made her feel more proud or more honored. And I didn't fucking do it. And it like brings me to tears when I think about what I could have shown her. And it's not like I wrote it because I wanted to make that right, but my mum was so massively a survivor of assault in the home growing up, sexual abuse, rape later in as a young woman, a survivor of like anti-Semitism, and then a survivor of cancer. And she had done this writing for the BBC, for BBC Radio 4. She had written this play about her experience of coming on her period for the first time, because in the Jewish tradition, some women, if your family does it, are slapped around the face when they get their first period by the matriarch of the family. And my mum didn't know that that was coming and she didn't know to expect it, and her grandmother slapped her. And she wrote, it's supposed to bless the baby, but she was really like the baby that you might have, which again is also like problematic, like just because I'm bleeding doesn't mean I'm gonna like bear children, but whatever. She had written this radio play about that experience, and I took some, after she passed, I took some of her text and I weaved it into this poem. I took things that other women had said to me of like different ethnicities and different generations. And I expanded the writing. And then because I was in a place where I was no longer in that aforementioned relationship, I was then able to really address it in the work and show me your bruises then. So this 3-page poem became 7 pages. And I then showed it to Kush Jumbo and Sienna Miller and asked them if they would be up for bringing it to life. And so the three of us created this 17-minute video work. Mm. Yeah.
Zoe, can I just say to you, darling, that you know, your the courage, the conviction, the emotional intelligence, the fearlessness, your ability to, you know, create work which connects, has meaning, is disruptive, is, you know, visionary is, you know, you've done that since you started, and your mum saw every single part of that, and that was given to you, sounds like, so much from your mum. Yeah. You know, so I, what I'm saying to you is, I don't think there needed to be an explicit named mention of her in your work for it to be so clear, certainly from the outside, how the spirit and influence and honouring of the person that your mum was is laced into every single part of what you do.
Thank you.
And, you know, it's just from the outside and sort of seeing, you know, everything that you went through with her illness and her passing, and then, but just seeing the bigger picture of what you've done for years, really, and then just learning a little bit more about the person that your mum was. For me, I was just like, you know, there was that just correlation. Wow, look at this incredible mother she has. And that is just so comes through in everything that you do, everything that you are. It didn't need to happen in one specifically named moment. It's just innate in every single thing that you are. And your mum knew that. Of course she did.
Thank you so much.
Of course she did. Of course she did. Of course she did, darling. Yeah. Don't have regret about that. Don't carry that around.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Don't do it. You're right. I feel things all the time that I wish I'd done there before. And it's like, what? There is not a world, any world in which your mum wouldn't have known and seen and burst with pride every day at what you did, and to be able to sort of see how she had, you know, the role that she had played in raising this extraordinary young woman who was taking all of that spirit that she had, you know, shown to you through your whole life and turning it into something which is your own. You know, what more could you ask as a mother? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, thank you.
You gave her that gift throughout your whole life. Your whole life. And definitely, I'm sure, you know, the work that she saw of yours in a sort of professional capacity, you know, spelt that out to her. So don't carry that around. You said earlier about, you know, how grief, there are all of these things, that, you know, definitely about grief and gratitude and all these other things. But those very, very dark, chaotic feelings involved in grief as well. And rage is a massive one of them. Rage and regret and all these horrible, horrible things. There is absolutely no way in which, you know, your mum was not as proud of you as she could have been, even if, you know, we could have had them for 20, 30, 40, 50 more years. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, we also know that nothing would vex them more than us carrying around something like that. Mm. Nothing would make our mums more vexed than to know that we were carrying around like unnecessary pain as a result of their passing. And so I remind myself of that as much as I can, but it's also, it's like, it's so hard because you're like, but I am fucking angry and I do feel bad about that. And I know that my mum would be so devastated to know how unhappy I've been about her death. Does that make any sense? My mum has this mantra, you know, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. And she would take into like her body and her being and every fiber of her emotion, like any of our anxiety or pain or whatever. My mum would lose sleep. No, even if our grandkids were waiting on finding out if they're getting into a school, my mum wouldn't sleep. If someone was going through something, my mum was terribly like racked with anxiety as an empath for her children or her grandchildren. And so I know that she would hate how much pain I've been in about, specifically about her passing. And yet, I just am. Do you know what I mean?
I know, darling. I know. I feel the same. And, you know, when people say to you, oh, God, your mum wouldn't want you to be sad, you're like, yeah, but if it was that fucking easy, then that would be great. It's like, you can't, and that's part what's so hard about it, is you can't turn it off. I know as you do, there's nothing in the world that would make my mum or your mum feel worse than to think of how unbearably sad we have been since each of our mums died. But that in and of itself can't stop the feeling, and it's, yeah, no, it's so, I think it's helpful sometimes when I think about it in terms with my kids, and maybe you have this with your daughter as well. I do sometimes think, God, imagine, you know, the day when, you know, I'm no longer here, you would want nothing more than the girls just to be okay and to not feel, yeah. And sort of, I mean, that, yeah, I mean, that sometimes helps a little bit, but I also just think it's this thing of time. You use the words metabolize, which is exactly a word that I found myself using, because it is that, it's more than processing. It's like metabolizing is something which literally has to work through the deepest yeah. part of your system. But I also think, and this is something else I've heard you say, that, you know, when somebody as close to you as both of our mothers was, as your mother was, dies, there's a huge part of you that dies with them. Yeah. And the thing that I wasn't prepared for, and I can see this in some of the beautiful things you've written about your lost Zoe as well, which is that no one prepared me for the fact that the death of my mother, and I think this probably goes for the death of somebody who's deeply, 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 deeply close to you, mm-hmm. with the death of them, a very real part of you dies too. Because ultimately, I think we exist in relation. Obviously, there's a huge part of us which is total in ourselves, but huge parts of us exist only in relationship to people. And so the part of us which existed only in relationship to that person, yes. particularly if they are a huge psychological part of who you are, literally dies with them. So when this person dies, not only are you grieving them, but you're also deeply grieving a very huge psychological part, you know, existential part of yourself that doesn't exist anymore as well, the missing yeah. parts of yourself which have died with them.
Absolutely.
And no one Absolutely. Prepares you for how existential that experience of grief is.
Yeah,
it's a complete yeah. reconfiguration of yourself, you know, self with a capital S, in
yeah
in the truest way.
Yeah, yeah, because there's also this whole role that was part of your identity, but part of like what you spent a lot of your time doing, which was being a daughter to your mother, and suddenly that role is just cut off, and with it all this wisdom, which, like, I constantly now, because my daughter is going through, you know, preteen, becoming a woman, changes, and I don't fucking remember what it was like to be like, I remember little bits here and there and a cloud of weed smoke about around the time when I got my first period and whatnot, but I want to be able to go back to my mum and be like, okay, did I tell you I hate, what was the first time that I told you I hated you? Because I know a mother never forgets that. I haven't forgotten the first time Cleo yelled through tears, I hate you. And like, I want to know, there's so much like wisdom and insight that I'm seeking right now. And I don't want to hear it from somebody else's mum. I want to know what I was like then, what it was like in the house then. And, you know, that died with my mum. My dad, I didn't speak to my dad about that stuff. He was not your guy when it came to becoming a woman. And now here I am raising my kids. And so I'm like, I guess with grief, when you lose someone like a mum, assuming you were close and they were a guide and they were, you know, a friend, there's going to be in our life, you and I, that we're going to be confronted with that loss time and time again in ways that we might not even expect.
Well, I think the loss is so multidimensional that it takes, you know, it constantly reveals itself in new ways and yeah. unexpected ways. And you don't know just until time just happens, and it's why sometimes, you know, you even experience their loss in the smallest, most mundane things many years afterwards, and those are moments that still have the power to floor you, You know, it's like there's not a single part of your world that that loss doesn't touch. And so you almost have to kind of walk through the whole scope of your world, which, you know, all the places that you go to, the things that you do, the people you see, the music you listen to, the food that you eat, the times that you have. You almost have to revisit every single one of those things again to really experience the full scope of it. And it keeps revealing itself, of course.
Yeah.
That kind of intersection between motherhood and the thing of just how important, and I know that a lot of your work kind of leans into this, the stuff around kind of like the importance of kind of intergenerational threads between women. And it's just the most painful separation, isn't it, when as a mother you feel kind of just severed from the source of this like ultimate wisdom and love and, you know, guidance. And it's still to this day, I think, the thing I find hardest about my mum dying, not only in my own loss, but that lack of, you know, I don't know. It's
You're right. It's like, I completely know what you mean. It's that line. It's like that that thread and connection to like your past and your mum's past, and like falling in line with your ancestral heritage, and you have to try really, really hard if you want to like the world is changing so fast now. Like, it's with the death of our mothers, it's like we get further and further away from our ancestral past. And I think in a way that it feels, maybe every generation feels this way, but I feel like the leaps that have occurred in the last 50 years have just been so astronomical that it's like you really have to like double down on trying to connect to like what life was like for your grandparents or when your mum was a kid and whatnot. And the more that they go, the less access you have to that knowledge.
And Zoe, it's so amazing like talking to you about this, because there's lots of this that it's a testament to how powerfully you managed to express these things in your work, but that's so manifest in your work for me, this kind of, you know, there's how like all of your pieces somehow bear traces of, they kind of speak to that thing of the traces of the past, and, you know, using vintage fabrics and, you know, and that sense of, they feel incredibly contemporary in their commentary, but just the kind of use of the older fabrics and these very old traditional techniques that you use kind of just really imply that sense of kind of looking backwards as well, and honouring the importance of kind of intergenerational experience, and how, you know, you can take the sort of metaphor of the thread and the wheat. I mean, you can, you know, into so many, and how we are all connected and how all these experiences are connected. And, and there's something about the, you know, your work, and which, I mean, literally, maybe I'm taking the metaphor too far now, which really binds us all together in this, in our shared experiences as women. That is why I think it's proving to have such a universal voice and is starting to kind of become as sort of well known as it is, because I think it really speaks to a lot of the universal experience. And
thank you.
Am I picking up on the right thing there?
No, absolutely. I want people to have those experiences.
You're like, all right, Jess, stop getting so fucking deep about it. No, it's just
100. Let's deep it.
But is that right? No, because that's how I sort 100%. Of saw it. Yeah.
You're dead on, because that's why I've chosen. I use, as you know, like mainly textiles, and within that, a hell of a lot of hand embroidery, and I use vintage textiles, and now I'm even like collecting in and sewing with vintage threads. They're prettier. But also I want to speak to like universal truths and experiences, and how like some things are age old, and these sort of like not just inherited trauma, but like also inherited creativity and joy and caretaking. And like, I know that that's not a great term, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that some things are inevitable. Women are going to have their power taken away from them. Like, we're seeing this, there's things are going backwards here in America. And, you know, all over the world, it's like, where is the actual progress that we can anchor to when it comes to the female experience? Like, we're going to have our power taken away from us in some way, physically, emotionally, financially, spiritually, or any combination of those. And that's more likely to happen in the home. Mm. And that's most likely to happen in our intimate relationships with men. So that's kind of an inevitability. Another one is that we're gonna probably want to and endeavor to cover that up and not speak about it, brush it under the rug, make it taboo, take away the stain, take away the blood, put it on a hot wash, whatever that is, and find euphemisms. And that's another thing that we inherit, is this, like, the stigma is like, one, we inherit the thing that happens to us, and then we inherit the stigma and shame and like self-blame about the thing that happened or happens to us. And then on the flip side, what we inherit, particularly in the home, and this is more kind of antiquated and traditional, but I think that it will like morph into other modalities, but women typically, looking back, we are the caretakers and the homemakers, and there is actually, like, although that can be quite oppressive and can be put on us, there is also this like joy and creativity in that. And so a lot of why I enjoy to use vintage textiles is because I'm looking at how, like, this doily or this tea towel or this tablecloth or pillowcase or whatever it is came from hundreds of years ago, and it's seen some days and some nights and some home, and it's probably witnessed some trauma, but also, like, some women fucking loved
it. It's already got a story by the time you even use it.
Exactly. It's not a blank canvas, which makes it, like, amazing. So easy to build upon that. And then another thing that I want to look at in the work as well is, when I think about any difficult experience that I've had, it's always been my friends, my either female friends or female family members that have rallied around me. And that's what we do. Like, we make food and we take it over. Like, this person's just given birth. Oh, I'm going to make them my special sanitary towels with, like, lavender and aloe, and I'm going to freeze them. I'm going to take it over to my girlfriend's house because, oh, she's going to want to sit on one of those. And that's what we do. And you're like, oh no, my friend's just been left and dumped. Like, right, bring on the food, vodka also. Mm. And these things are age old, our capacity to hold each other. And I feel sorry that that is less of a tradition for men and in male relationships, this kind of, like, I don't know, rallying and showing up in these loving, nurturing, soft ways. Mm. And I feel very glad that we can lean into that softness for each other and for ourselves. Mm. And so all that to say, like, the textiles that I use and the embroidery, like, I want it to do two things. Like, I want it to speak to, like, all of the shit that we've had to go through generationally that we really shouldn't have to anymore, but we do, as well as, like, all the pleasure that we have found within these spaces.
Mm. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side?
helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think the way in which women can hold each other in relationships and in friendships has it's the most, I'm speaking from my own personal experience, it's the most all-encompassing of any relationship I have. It is the relationships that my relationships which literally hold the full spectrum of who I am, like no other. Do you know what I mean? It's like everything is in the mix of that relationship. There's nothing which is restrained from it or hidden from it, or you are fully your whole, well, speaking from my own experience, but it sounds like this is mirroring what you're saying. There is this capacity within female friendships to be the full wholeness of who you are in that relationship in a way that you can't quite in any other relationship. But I don't. Family members, you know, my partner, I mean, he gets a lot of me, but there's part of me who's like, he doesn't want to even fucking know that bit of me. get that bit of you away from me. But do you know what I mean? But with girls, it's 100%. Not that. You're just like, you are the full, rawest, fucking wholest version of yourselves together. Nobody holds you like your female. Well, for me, no one holds me like my female relationships hold me
100% in the way that you need in that moment. Like you and I connected because of our mutual friend Rose Aldenton.
Rose is
Core.
You better be listening to this, Rose.
Hi Rose, we love you. She best listen, you know she's been listening. Rose is like my blood. She's blood, and she has sat at my mum's kitchen table and cried as a teenage girl. My mum's like wiped her tears. Rose's my mum's handed Rose my mum's weed box. Rose has rolled the spliff because my mum could never bill up cute. And you know, like we've had so many nights around my mum's kitchen table. It was like, and then when I moved to New York, when I would come back and visit and I would stay with my mum, and she was, you know, she put flowers in my little bedroom, and she was the first person I'd see when I get off the flight and all the things. My first night in London, it was always like, right, when is Rose coming over? Like, that's how deep it is. And then when that relationship that I was in, the 2-year relationship that where I experienced this assault and trauma, really weird because Rose happened to be staying at my house when I was sexually assaulted by this man. And Rose was the person that I went to the next morning and didn't tell her the whole truth, told her half. I wasn't even ready to like really speak out loud fully what had happened, like the part B of that night. But it's amazing to me, like some kind of angel sent Rose to be in my home during that time. And then when that relationship ended, I got on a flight, and when I landed, Rose was there with tequila and she just held me while I wept. And so it's like, basically what I'm trying to say is thank God. Thank God for Rose, thank God for our girls. I'm really glad that I know you because of her. And I'm glad that you have women like that in your life too. I think we all need our girldom, our inner core, our sisters.
Zoe, there was something that I did want to talk about CHAMP, because particularly in terms of, you know, you mentioned a few minutes ago about how particularly now in America, you know, women's bodies and women's ability to make choices in the best interest of their bodies and their lives is more compromised now than it has been in the last, like, many decades. With obviously abortion no longer being protected under the Constitution in many, many states in America. And I know that that's meant that your work, CHAMP, which for any listeners who might not know, you must look it up. It's this incredible, it's a 43-foot neon of a uterus overlook, which is now, which for the last, is it 4 years, has been installed over Hollywood Boulevard since 2018. And in the place of the ovaries are a pair of boxing gloves. And from what I understand, Zoe, it was made in the run-up to the 2016 US election, amid all of, you know, big sort of political conversations around consent and abortion, contraception and rape, and obviously all the kind of tremors of Me Too. But, you know, 6 years later, where things have only regressed even further, where, as I said, abortion is now no longer protected under the Constitution in America, that piece has taken on a whole new meaning, hasn't it? And it's seen, I mean, I've seen it, you know, in many places being used as a symbol of that fight. That must feel pretty amazing to see that piece of work kind of take on a whole new, like, life in that world of sort of activism now as well.
Yeah, it's totally a double-edged sword, because I never wanted the piece to become more relevant. But it's gotten increasingly more relevant. Like, when I made it, it was really just like, I was super frustrated with what I was seeing on the news, and like flooding all the channels with all of these politicians, these fucking old white guys sitting around debating what is rape, what is rape, what is abortion because of rape, and all of this shit. And I had a personal experience by then of abortion, as well as other obstetric, you know, difficulty. And I just felt like there's a war on us. Like, I never imagined that there would be an abortion ban in certain states. And furthermore, that there would even be legislation to have people rat each other out. There's now like financial incentive in certain states where, like, if you know of a doctor performing an illegal abortion, if you rat on them, you get paid. Like, this is after a pandemic when people are struggling financially. Like, people will be making a career out of this. Like, I'm a professional ratter now. I just like hang out and like fucking, you know, listen.
I'm an abortion rat. I mean, are you fucking kidding me?
That's how I'm going to get paid. Because you know what? Fuck the state. The state never looked after me anyway. Fuck women. You know what? They're on their own. I'm going to get... Like, they could even be women doing it as well. Like, these rats. Like, it's that deep. Like, and the patriarchy is that entrenched. It's just so fucked. Sorry, tangent. But when I made this piece, it was really more about what I was experiencing, what I was thinking about, my rage, and also my like, oh, like, we're fucking lights, like, there's lights in us, for fuck's sake. And so I made it small. It had to sort of anatomically work with the boxing gloves that I was carrying around in my bag. I was training at the time, and so I kind of like drew it out on my studio wall. I pinned the boxing gloves up, and I was like, okay, if those are ovaries, that means a uterus has to be about this big. Drew it out, sketched it, got it made neon, showed it a little bit. I exhibited it in a group show in Chelsea before the election. This is the only, to my knowledge, bad review. I'm not trying to tempt fate. Listen, when it happens, it happens. But there was a writer, cisgender white man, who reviewed that show and said, oh, and Zoe Buckman's piece screams, we're still fighting for our rights.
Oh, fuck off.
Fuck off, suck my dick. I met him years later, or maybe like a year later, and he came up to me and he was like, "Hi, you're Zoe Buckman." And I said, "Yeah." And he was like, "I'm really sorry. I wrote that article, and you're right. You are still fighting for your rights." So I was like, "Oh wow, thanks. I'm gonna get a drink now." But anyway,
fucking twat.
Again, I digress. Twat. Everyone thought Hillary Clinton's about to become the first female president. Like, bitches, be quiet. There's nothing to complain about. I was one of the people that thought Hillary Clinton was about to become the first female president of the United States. But I still knew whoever's in that top seat, like, we must be afraid, very afraid, on a personal level, on a governmental level, legislatively, even like, you know, if you look at the whole of America, if you look at the whole of the globe, no, we need a neon uterus. I'm going to make this peace. But I just didn't expect that then, boom, Donald Trump's president, and then that piece is like everywhere. It's on, there's images of it in the Women's March, and then Art Production Funds, this organization came to me and they said, "Do you want to make this huge and we'll put it on Sunset Boulevard?" And I said, "Yes." And we did that, and then it sort of coincided with, you know, in LA, everything blowing up in Hollywood and Me Too, and then boom, it was more relevant again. And then Supreme Court, and it kind of like had this new life, and new people were sharing images of it. And like, basically, in answer to your question, now when I see it, I now associate it with, oh God, what has just happened? Like, when I see that someone's shared it online, I'm like, oh no, wait, is there a new piece of news that hasn't updated on my CNN app, you know?
Right.
So I don't really like it anymore, to be honest with you. I want it to go away. If anyone wants to buy it, contact my gallery. But I don't want to look at it anymore.
Well, it also just is, just listening to you to describe, you know, just over the last sort of 4 to 6 years that that piece has been in existence in its different forms, you know, the multiple different moments of which it's kind of risen up to be a symbol of yet another moment of, you know, representing a kind of the resistance from women to, you know, the amount that constantly needs to be fought against. And it's like just in different guises, but it's this, it's same thing, but dressed up in a different guise, you know, and it's the relentlessness of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the relentlessness God, that's really interesting, Zoe, to think of thing if you think of it like that. But it's also,
I hate my uterus.
No, but it is. But it is interesting for me when I see it. It's also a symbol of hope, I think.
Yeah.
It does embody that as well, and it does. I think it does embody hope.
You're right. I have to connect to that, because I've had so many beautiful emails from women about that, seeing that in that piece. And I remember I was at like an art event, and this woman came up to me and she was like, I put your piece as my screensaver on my phone after I had a miscarriage. And it was such a dark, dark time for me. And just looking at it, and it brought her solace and hope and reminded her of her intrinsic strength and resilience and beauty, you know, beauty on the inside, beauty on the outside. You've got this.
Yeah.
And I was like, boom, right there. Thank you. That makes me happy. That feels like success to me. That's what success is.
Well, it's the power of sort of, It is the kind of incomparable power of art as well, the way that it can, you know, find its way into so many different people's lives, and it to acquire its own and often evolving and changing meaning. You know, it has a life, an enduring life of its own. So Zoe, listen, I mean, I wish you were around the corner so we could go and pick this up at the fucking pub.
Yes,
but you're not, although I might get on a plane and come and see you in New York.
The pubs aren't as good, but we could go for a cocktail. I'll make you a beer.
Listen, I'm going to make that happen. I'm actually going to make it happen. But listen, as we move into the sort of the closing parts of this amazing time we've had with you, Zoe, I wanted to ask you, what does courage feel like?
Wow, that's such an awesome... No one has ever asked me that. I feel like courage has a heat to it, because it's something that's like, because I think that heat creates power, right? And so it's like something that you can use like a fuel, but it's also a little bit scary in the way that heat is, and simultaneously comforting. And I feel like courage encapsulates all of that. Like the times when I've felt courageous, or where I felt in touch with my inner courage, I've been very grateful for it. And but it can also be scary. And I think particularly, I think, you know, especially for marginalized people, because we're not encouraged to connect with that. And so it can come with like a kind of handle with caution warning, a sense of it, you know. But so yeah, I would say it feels warm, dangerous, and at the same time like vital and life-giving.
Amazing. I love that. We've never had that answer before. I love that.
You know the time where I felt most powerful in my whole life was when I was giving birth, and I was shit scared, but I also wasn't. It was really, really, there was so much going on all at once, and it was almost like I didn't have time to eat. I didn't have the capacity to even think or feel, right? Because I have this one thing to do, and I'm doing this one thing, and it's only like some months and weeks afterwards that I was able to even reflect back. But I remember I've never felt so in control, and I've never felt so powerful, and I was fortunate, and I did it without pain medication. I did it at home, but I was able to, like, for the first time in my life, kind of command my space myself. And I knew somewhere from somewhere else, whether it was ancestral or internal or both, like I knew what to do. And I'd never obviously done it before. I've only done it once. And somehow I knew what to do, and being put in touch with that strength and that courage cracked me open in ways where I was able to say, I'm an artist, I have something to say, and that started everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And it was frightening, like that I was an animal, I became an animal.
God, I mean, this is a whole other thing to respond to that. For me, the experience of birth, like the experience of death, is the ultimate lesson in what is bearable as a human being.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing. The second thing is, there is that moment, isn't there, in birth where you suddenly feel yourself split from human to mammal. And suddenly it's just like, and just what you just said about the intergenerational sort of that feeling of being connected to something intergenerational. When I was giving birth, I had this sort of transcendental like moment where it was the same. I was at home and I didn't have any pain medication, but it wasn't actually, I shouldn't have been, because I was actually really high risk. I went into like, I basically gave birth in, I had a really like 52 hours of like having contractions 7 minutes apart, oh, sorry, yeah. 7 minutes apart. And then I went from that to literally Middle Earth, death roar, I'm giving birth in 90 seconds.
No, oh my God.
Yeah, and so I didn't even have a midwife with me, and I was really high risk, and I was meant to be on a ward, delivered by an obstetrician, all of that stuff. And I was on my own with my husband, and they, a paramedic arrived like literally a minute and a half before I pushed my baby out.
Oh my God. Oh
and
my
caught
God.
Her, and the midwife was on the phone, and that was it. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But there was this one moment, you talk about being scared, and I just had this moment of just like, oh my fucking God, I cannot believe it. I'm giving birth. This is absolutely fucking insane. And I'm on my own. And I've been told if I had birth, I couldn't even have birth in the birth ward because I was birth centre because I was told that it was too dangerous for me. And there's this moment where the midwife is saying, you're going to have to push the baby out now. Next contraction. And I was like, okay, I need to push this baby. I need to do it now. Well, not, I didn't have a choice because it was happening anyway. And I was like, is this the moment that I'm going to die? As I'm giving birth as I'm giving birth to my daughter. And it all happened in the space of like 10 minutes, really fast. But I suddenly had this moment where I suddenly felt connected to every woman, past, present and future, who has done this thing of passing life through them and forward. And I just went, oh, and I just thought, I can fucking do it. And I just fucking pushed her out and she was perfect and I was fine. Oh, and it was like, what the fuck? And the whole room just collapsed. And I tell you, it was my mum arrived 30 seconds before I gave birth. And she was there reaching over the paramedic, like holding on to me. And she was fucking shitting herself as well because she knew that how dangerous this was. And the whole room just like collapsed and like burst into tears of like joy and relief. And my baby girl was there. And I couldn't, it was fucking insane. But it is that thing, going back to this intergenerational thing. That was
you
like,
are a legend. What a fucking story.
No, babe, but it came
you
to me.
You are a fucking legend. But well, yes, that connection.
I didn't have I didn't have a fucking choice. I did not have a choice. And you just do it. You have to do what you've got to fucking do. But that thing that you're talking about, that intergenerational sort of moment of like, honestly, I could feel connected to every woman in the world giving birth in that moment, and it helped me fucking, it pushed me over the edge. Wow. It was incredible. The most terrifying, exhilarating, excruciating, like transcendental, like awe-inspiring, terrifying, like every single fucking thing you can imagine is there in that moment, isn't it?
1,000%. Isn't it? It's just pure raw experience. It's pure raw mammal, like you said. It's everything.
Did you get the Middle Earth death roar?
All the blame.
Do you?
It went to some next level. I think that's why I still have a croaky voice. I think I fucked one of my vocals giving birth. I can't even smoke cigarettes anymore.
Oh my God, that's just fucking finished me off. I so know. I think we should all have that. All fucking women who've given birth should walk around with a quirky voice. Fucking hell. And the rest. Jesus Christ. Oh, that's amazing. All right, so I might have one more thing before we go.
Yes.
If there is one person in the world that you'd want to be proud of you, and they can be alive or they could have passed away, who would that be and why?
Well, I want my mum to be proud of me, but I know she is. Mm. And I want my daughter to be proud of me, but I think she is, but I hope that she continues to be. So I'm going to say that. I'm going to say my daughter, Kia.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We'll see. Remains to be seen. We'll find out.
Oh, darling. Life I fucking love you.
She'll tell her.
I'm getting on Skyscanner now, and I'm really sorry. It's.
Yes.
I don't know if you think that's a promise or a threat, but I am gonna.
I love it. I'm with you. The kettle is on and the bed is made. Please come through.
Oh my God! Wicked, amazing, darling. This has been so brilliant.
So good.
Zoe,
thank
you for all you are, for all you do, for being the most incredible season finale guest for us in this series of Human. You're just amazing. You're just amazing. Thank you so much. And so listen, in true human form, we ask our guests every week to play us out with a song. So if there is a song that you would dedicate to this conversation, what would it be and why?
It's going to be, it's my anthem. It's called Flowers by Sweet Female Attitude. This is for the galdem. This is for love. This is for joy. And this is for Hackney. Ooh! And this is for you, Jess. Yeah! Mwah!
Thank you, darling. Here we have it.
Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you, Zoe.
Bye, love.
Bye, darling. Thank you all so much for listening. If you'd like to rate, review and subscribe to us on your podcast app, then please do. And you know the score, 5 stars, please. If you'd like to come and say hello on Instagram, then you can find me and all things human podcast related at This Is Jess Mills. This podcast was created and hosted by me, Jess Mills, with creative co-production by Bonnie Tyburn and produced by Joel Porter at ...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.